it's a lot of waiting around for the provincial government and sort of begging them to do stuff without a ton of power. Did you guys have any other takeaways, Armand?
Yeah. One thing I was thinking about is the use of stories, how, you know, mm-hmm. when you have this kind of decision where, you know, you have a lot of statistics and you have a lot of uncertainty about how it's going to affect different groups, how all the counselors told a story of a particular individual and how that influenced their decision, that in a policy that's going to affect nearly every property owner in Vancouver.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And who brought that up? I think someone said everyone has a story. Everyone's affected by story. I think it was Dr. Hamilton. And yeah, because this issue is like, you know, we're all talking here in the studio. It just like, it's such a complex issue. And you can look at it from so many different angles and see so many different complexities and really argue both sides pretty effectively. That's why, you know, council was so close on the vote. It was a 6-5 vote. But at the same time, so as a result of that, people tend to lean on like emotional antidotes, right? Like we heard Melissa DeGenova talking about how, you
her
know,
daughter.
Her daughter, right? How like, you know, if she was a homeowner and needed the money or whatever, her daughter thinking about how she might not be able to feed her daughter is like very upsetting. And then Rebecca Bly had an emotional story on the opposite end. And like Pete Fry changed his vote because he got a letter, right, from someone at the dog park.
We're still not sure what
we're not sure if the dog park is a literal dog park or if it's like a place, like whatever. Anyway,
like it could
but
be
he,
a coffee shop, maybe.
It could be a coffee shop. Is that what he... Yeah, he's a business owner too, I think. So maybe it's his... Whatever.
I could just Google the dog
park. We could just Google it. But anyway, like, he got a letter from a business owner who was like, I'm going to leave because I can't keep affording to exist here in Vancouver. And that's why he ended up voting the way he did. Yeah. On the other end, you know, you hear rhetoric. Jean Swanson has said, you know, repeatedly, we just gave a tax break to Walmart. And Kennedy Stewart was saying that too. And that's true too. That's technically true too. So... And what we were also debating here, where is Walmart in Vancouver? Is there a Walmart? What did we discover, John?
So I initially thought that there actually wasn't a Walmart in Vancouver because, I mean... Because
well, where is it?
Because I just couldn't think of it. I just could never remember having seen one in Vancouver before.
Yeah.
And I mean, I feel like, not to brag, but I feel like I know the city pretty well.
Yes.
You clearly. But I actually Googled around and there actually is a Walmart in Vancouver. It's just... kind of deep into like southeast Vancouver.
It's on Boundary Road.
It's on Boundary Road, so pretty much really close to the
Burnaby.
Yeah.
So thanks to the great journalistic efforts of the CITR News Collective, we have confirmed that there is a Walmart in Burnaby and it will get
Vancouver,
a tax break
actually.
Sorry Vancouver. Accidentally saying the wrong thing there. Well, we're 3 minutes after 6. The news show is over time. Thank you so much for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. Up next, we have the Spencer Latu show. I think that's what it's called. It's definitely led by Spencer Latu. So stay tuned for that. And
does he have a show on CITR by any chance?
He does.
Whoa.
Oh, are you being funny?
I'm trying, but I'm not funny.
Okay. Spencer Latu's up next. Thanks for tuning into CITR. We'll be back again next Thursday at 5 p.m. with more Democracy Watch. And subscribe to our podcast, Seeking Office. So, all right. Take care.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
If you're one of the millions of Canadians who experience depression, anxiety, or some other...
What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We're a progressive politics show broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory on UBC's Point Grey campus. I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and we are joined by a very special guest, journalists for our very own student newspaper, the UBC, for today's show. Hi, Sammy.
Hi.
We'll be speaking truth to power about the pigs, Coca-Cola, prayer space at UBC, and if we have time, Venezuela. But before we get to all that, I would like to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. And rather than keeping this as a tokenistic gesture to the Indigenous peoples of Canada, as is generally done on UBC's campus, we will keep the Indigenous struggle for self-determination and justice at the forefront of our consciousness. We'll begin this show and every show until there's justice for Indigenous people, talking about colonialism. So for today's discussion about colonialism, I saw this in the news coming from where else for really horrible things, really racist stuff being said. I recently did a paper about Colton Bushy. I got a terrible mark on it, but what are you going to do? I still learned a lot. So yeah, Saskatchewan, really racist place. It's that Balfour, Saskatchewan is where the largest mass execution has ever happened in Canada. And naturally, it was all Indigenous men from the Northwest Rebellion that happened there. So there's a little fun little history note for everybody. And that was when John A. MacDonald said that, you know, the red man will learn the white man rule. So, you know, you can always tell why people are executed. Generally, you know, if there's a mass execution, there's a political motivation behind it.
Something going on.
Yeah, there might be something. Also, Ajit, I forgot to introduce you. Hi, Ajit.
Hello.
Yeah, okay. Sorry about that. That's so, so the headline is, racial slur was not used in arrest video, RCMP say, but LaRoche Mayor calls language unacceptable. This story contains explicit language, so earmuffs to all young people. So this was written by Janani Whitfield of CBC News, posted April 30th, 2019. The article reads, videos posted online of police arrests have sparked anger amongst some La Loche, Saskatchewan residents, but a Saskatchewan RCMP official says the videos do not tell the full story. One of the videos shows an arrest made in La Loche, a village 514 kilometers northwest of Saskatoon, on Sunday. The video appears to have been filmed by a person near an outbuilding. In the video, police members are seen entering the video, shouting multiple commands for everyone to get on the ground as the suspect was considered armed and dangerous. According to police, one man refused to comply with police direction, leading to an exchange of words between police and the suspect. La Loche Mayor Robert St. Pierre says when he watched the video, he heard a voice that he believed was a female member saying, "Fucking savages," from inside the building. So we're going to play the video here. This is courtesy of CBC News. You can hear for yourself. There's the cops entering. Oh, well then, so I don't know about you guys, but I heard a female member saying fucking savages. What are your thoughts?
I actually heard her say, to me it sounded like she said F you savages. Seriously. Like that's any better. But
yeah, okay, okay. Like, some debate, okay, embrace debate. Okay, Sammy?
Oh yeah, she absolutely said fucking savages. And I noticed that in the article they mentioned that like the RCMP were like, oh no, she said sack of shit. And it's like, is that any is that much better?
Yeah.
But like the cadence that she said it with, it's obviously savages that yeah. she's saying.
Right. Yeah, it's like unless you really drew out like, I don't know if it's sack or shit, which word you'd have to draw out to make it sound like that, but it's clear, mm-hmm. like clearly fucking savages. So, okay, so naturally, how do police deal with things? Well, they did an internal investigation, so a statement from the police force said it had reviewed the video extensively, which I can only imagine was somebody in between donuts clicking replay on that 35-second video. The RCMP is confident that a racial slur was not used. However, we acknowledge the video does contain expletive language, and we are reviewing the use of this language. Okay, so obviously this is bullshit. So I think this is like very careful, like, oh, like logic bro, you know, like this is what the cops have embraced is that, you know, it's not a racial slur, the word savage. Like it's not like, you know, the word itself, you know, but obviously, you know, when you're directing it at indigenous peoples, there's that whole, I don't know, hundreds of years worth of history and the current, you know, genocide that goes on that really makes that word like more than loaded. But I would consider it a racial slur.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. like remember like a few years ago, like people started using the word savage to describe things that were like, oh, they totally owned them. They'd like say like that was savage. And it's yeah. like, that's bad. We shouldn't say that. And people started noticing that, I felt, yeah. on Twitter, at least in leftist circles. And mm-hmm. they're like, we should stop. But I think, like, a cop doing it has so much more, like,
yes.
like brevity to it. Because it's, like, the RCMP have such a long history of oppressing indigenous people. It's like, don't yeah. say that, honey. No.
Yeah, yeah. When you're wearing the uniform, you're already like a colonizer. Because mm-hmm. you know who was ripping kids away from their families to take them to residential schools? The cops. Mm-hmm. You know who's clearing the plains and starving these people and executing people throughout all the treaty all the treaty signings that were happening that were very dubious. If you look into it, people, I really suggest looking into that. It's very, very sketchy stuff. It's all the cops. So, I mean, I think, like, that's a really good point that, you know, because it's a cop, it's, like, doubly loaded. So, back to the article. Filming allowed, but position dangerous, RCMP. Another video showed the person being filming being told to get the fuck out of here, with the video then going black. Constable, I don't know, Pig Rob King, a spokesperson for the Saskatchewan RCMP, said that the people are allowed to film police interactions, but in this case, the person was pushed out of the way because of the nature of the situation. They're in too dangerous of a position, he said. St. Pierre said he spoke with a sergeant in charge of the detachment and told him he was disappointed in how the situation was handled and that the language used was unacceptable. He said he would leave any further action to the detachment. So, for me, I was thinking, you know, what kind of danger are these people? And I'm like, yeah, probably getting shot by the cops. You know, who's the most dangerous person in this situation? You know, this quote-unquote armed and dangerous person, which you can just tell they're clearly not armed and dangerous, because if they were, then the cops would have put that in the article if they actually had a weapon. So they just said, oh, they were considered armed and dangerous. So thus we now know after the fact the person that the incident they were going to had nothing to do with any weapons. So it's just, once again, pigs being pigs, all cops are bastards, and they're just, you know, just taking their, you know, their bullying from high school out on these people and using our colonial structures to, you know, have their really sick pleasure of putting on the uniform and go getting the bad guys, which just so happens to be oppressed peoples.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I think just the ease that she used the statement, and it's quite telling of, like, the kind of, you know, the type of nature or, like, kind of the environment that they foster in the police force. The fact that, you know, the indigenous community is, like, the most preyed upon in Canada in terms of by the police. So, yeah, the fact that she used it, I don't think it didn't seem out of the ordinary to her, because they already, you know, the indigenous people already kind of framed in a certain way by, I'm sure, her sergeant and her staff sergeant or shift lieutenant, whatever. So it's just a chain of command thing. So it's yeah. just, yeah.
Yeah. It's like it's a very top down kind of ideology of, you know, this is how we treat these people. Exactly. It's not like, you know, the police are supposed to serve and protect. So serve and protect who? Then becomes the question. It's pretty obvious.
Not these people.
No, certainly not these people. It's rich people and protecting property from the fucking savages, as they like to say. So one last point I want to get to. So in a very small town, middle of nowhere, you know, 500 kilometers away from Saskatoon, which is also in the middle of nowhere. So we're in the middle of nowhere, that there was another arrest on Sunday and it was captured on video. And it was shared multiple times on social media and was described as showing police roughing up a disabled person for an open can of beer. So I just wanted to get to that because, you know, what a busy police force, you know, for such a small town, they really find a way to harass as many natives as they can.
Yeah, I didn't know that having an open can of beer was a crime. I mean, it's not a crime in Quebec. Why is it in Saskatchewan?
Yeah, it's drinking while Indigenous. You get like, you know, you get a special kind of crime, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I just think it's very interesting when people like talk about how great the cops are for solving problems, because, you know, here's the nexus of it. You know, intergenerational trauma with, you know, and disabilities. So, you know, we could be spending money on, you know, health programs and, you know, ways to make the world more accessible and dealing with mental health crisis and intergenerational trauma. No, spend more money on cops, because that's clearly going to help somebody.
Right.
Yeah. So I personally take the police and prison abolition stance on all these things. I think that, you know, there needs to be a divestment from the cops and a reinvestment into the communities. Because what's the difference between, you know, these Indigenous communities with people with open drinks to, you know, Kitsilano with people with open drinks, right? One is invested and one's left to die.
Right. Exactly. In one situation, you know, you tell the person, just pour it out, man. In the other one, you rough them up and, you know, maybe throw them in the back of a cop car.
Yeah, you just beat up on, like, and the worst thing is, too, is, like, it's a disabled person, too, right? So, you know, not saying that they have no agency and they couldn't help themselves, but it's like, you know, why would you need to,
right,
like, fight them? What's wrong with you?
Pretty much, in terms of physical capability, they have very little agency, right?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, but that's just cops for you, right? So, you know, they got beat up, they got bullied in high school, or they just are complete failures in life, so they decide to go to the RCMP.
Right. Well, this is the other Canada that we don't, you know, ever really talk about, is that, you know, this rural society that, you know, just gets brushed away. You know, it's not in the media, it's not, like, discussed here on the coast or anything, and you know, this is exactly what we're talking about, it, that this sort of environment does exist.
Yeah, they're very, 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 it's flyover country. And I think honestly for good reason, because they're terrible and they treat everyone like shit, all the Indigenous people like shit out there. And they are very unapologetic about it. So, you know, good riddance to them. I hope all the worst for racist people in the prairies. Sammy, any thoughts?
I think that having an open can of beer shouldn't be a crime.
Yeah.
I think we should all just take the progressive stance on alcohol in like every province and realize like, having a open can of alcohol isn't, like, anything that a police officer should care about. Like, even if it's still going to be a crime, it shouldn't even be enforced. Like, you're not hurting someone by having an open can of alcohol. If you're using it as an excuse to, like, assault somebody, like, that's absolutely unacceptable. Especially in this case where they're, like, clearly, like, trying to use their, like, their talents and oppression to oppress further. It's too much.
It is too much, and I agree with you. Yeah, fuck the police. Okay, we're gonna take a short break for commercials. We'll be right back.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
This band is really good, and I've been wanting to find out more about local music.
Yeah, I heard about it through CITR and Discorder.
What's that?
It's a radio station. You can review all the music that comes in and help out with touring bands, or just do some data entry to get started in their music department.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you can just email volunteer@citr.ca and they can help you get into the station or just come in whenever.
Well, I'll be there, so.
Heavy Metal Radio. It'll have you saying, yeah. Tune in every Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m.
Yeah. What's up? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show. I'm your host, Spencer Latu. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
Hello.
And we're here with our very special guest from our very own UBC, Sammy Smart, fantastic investigative journalist. And she wrote an amazing piece. This is in the UBC. It's from was this October? Mm-hmm. October 2018. Must read if you've ever seen those. All the, you know, I've... Ever since I read this article, I can't help but look at water fountains and vending machines differently. So I would say it's a must read for all UBC students and people that know anything about Coca-Cola or have ever come into contact with Coca-Cola before. So so I guess I'll start off with my first question. So I will start by thanking you for joining us again. You've with this insight into Coca-Cola, you gave me at least more ammunition to prove to people how much of a fake progressive institution we're at right now. So thank you for that. And could you give us a quick little history lesson? You know, as a history major, I couldn't think of anything better to do with my time than get another history lesson. And I would love to hear about UBC and UBC, the Alma Mater Society, our very own student union, and Coca-Cola.
Yeah. So in 1995, Coca-Cola, the AMS, and UBC made a they like signed a contract together for a exclusive cold beverage agreement. So that would mean that Coca-Cola would basically have a monopoly on the beverage market at UBC and in UBC food services and AMS businesses as like the drink company. So that includes like Coca-Cola, Sprite, Dasani, all the stuff that we see like all the time.
Whoa, hold up. I thought I was being an informed consumer and enjoying my freedom under capitalism and picking multiple different brands in that Coca-Cola vending machine. Are you just trying to tell me they're all owned by the same company and they're creating an illusion of choice?
Yeah, like if you look at the back, it always says Coca-Cola Company on the back. So yeah, they entered that agreement in 1995 and it was met with a lot of backlash before it was ratified. And this is mostly because of a confidentiality clause in the agreement, which made it so that the AMS and the university couldn't publicly discuss the terms of the contract. So a then UBC reporter, Stanley Tromp, filed a Freedom of Information request, and it wasn't fulfilled until 2001. After involving like an appeal to the Supreme Court. He wasn't even a student at UBC anymore when it finally was like released.
I think that's like the number one play by this institution is just wait for people to graduate because like it's too hard to beat them in 4 years. By the time you recognize it, you're in second year, so you're already halfway out.
Yeah.
And they just expect you to give up on it. So shouts out to this guy for sticking it through.
Yeah, absolutely. And like there is like so the people that do FOI requests in BC, I believe I can't remember what the position's called. They're like. It's a provincial role, and that role had changed, and the person that was in the role after the first person was the one who, like, under him, it was, like, the FOI was accepted. So, like, it literally involved somebody taking over a role for it to actually come out. And it turns out that UBC was to receive $8.5 million from Coca-Cola over the 10 years of the contract, and the school, in order to get all this money, had to sell 33.6 million Coca-Cola products over the 10 years, which is, like, impossible. And they based this, I believe, on Rutgers University and other universities in America that had the same contract. And this was the first one of its kind in Canada, and they didn't realize that Canadian consumers don't drink as much Coke as American consumers. So, like, it was... Like 10 years into the deal, they hadn't even reached half, I believe, of the quota. So they had to like increase the contract and not have any extra funding. So we were just like beholden to Coca-Cola for even longer. And it wasn't until 2007 that the AMS decided to like back out of the agreement. So there was like finally Pepsi products.
Finally, yeah, some choice around here.
12 years with no Pepsi on this campus.
I'll go with Democrat. I mean, Pepsi. Anyways, wow, that's incredible. So, you know, doing the math here, so that's they have to sell almost $10,000 of those a day out on UBC's campus. Coke products.
Yeah, I'm bad at math, but I'll believe you on that.
Yeah, no, I was quickly doing this because I'm like, how much is that? So, okay, and then another interesting thing. Following the money here, So we find out that the UBC is making, you know, an extra $850K a year off this over 10 years, right? So $8.5 million over 10. Where did the money go?
Okay, so
because that's quite a bit of money, $8.5 million. I wonder where that would have gone to. Do you think that would that go for a fountain, open educational resources? Where did it go?
So what I found out was that David Strangway, he made an affidavit to the commissioner regarding the confidentiality of the agreement, saying that like almost all the profits of the deal would go to improving accessibility for disabled persons.
That's good.
But not a lot of it did. Only, according to an article that Trump wrote in 2001, at that point, only 640,000 of the dollars of the deal had been used for accessibility. And most of the, like, the largest cut had wound up in the marketing agents' pockets. So, yeah, 24% went to the middleman, which is like over $1 million. And so disabled access only got 10% of the total.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ajit, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, who's brokering these sort of deals? Like, I would assume that UBC had some sort of business acumen even back in 95. Like, let's say 33 million products, right? And let's say in 95 it was $1, right? Like, disregard inflation or anything. So we got to sell $33 million at minimum of their products, but we get $8.5 million over a 10-year period.
So $850K a year.
Which is, I mean...
It's insane.
In 1995, I'm sure...
I'm so glad we have Sauder School of Business now to do some better deals.
These awesome, you know, business majors. Yeah, I don't know. It just... Total discrepancy. And I mean, yeah, like you said, it was 600,000 or something, which went to the disability fund, which is, mm-hmm. I mean, less than 10% of the total, which is...
That's sick. Yeah. How gross is that to sell it to people? You said it was for people with disabilities, and you give that
They clearly knew this was a bad deal.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it was a good deal for their friend. This guy is connected to somebody in the UBC administration. Right. Whoever this marketing agent is,
I think that's,
he's somebody's friend.
That's what's in between the lines.
And it's just so sad. And then, of course, you know, we have to pretend like these people actually give a crap about any student here.
Right.
So that's obviously garbage.
But it gets worse.
Yeah, no, it does. It gets worse and worse every year. And I think that this was probably the most absurd thing of, I would say, what decade would this mostly be in? Would you say from the aughts, you know, 2000 to 2010, or from 1990 to 2000? Where do you think this fits into the most absurd, which decade? Or does it get both decades for the most absurd thing?
I think it probably gets both decades. I don't know enough about UBC's history to like truly say like, is this
check
the most
that,
absurd thing?
The UBC Properties Trust. That's the worst one by far. Yeah. Still to this day.
That's the behemoth.
Okay, so, you know, obviously we still have a deal with Coca-Cola because why, Sammy?
So right now we have a non-exclusive deal with Coca-Cola. So if there's no equivalent product, they can sell it. So like that like yerba mate drink that you see all around, it's not owned by Coca-Cola, but since Coca-Cola doesn't have an equivalent, they can sell that.
Hmm.
I don't really know the full details currently of our current agreement. It's different from the one that we entered in 1995. It seems a little bit less oppressive. I'm sure we're still getting money as
we're in an open abusive relationship. They only abuse us on the weekends.
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty good. Okay, it was better than we were doing in the aughts. Okay, so this is by far the best part of the article. I'm going to say that right now because I get to put on my tinfoil hat and I get to do my best InfoWars Alex Jones impersonation, and you discuss the strange disappearances of forestry building water fountains. And I would naturally gravitate to this conspiracy theory that it would be profitable to deprive students of water fountains, socializing the cost of bottled beverage products, making the entire planet pay the cost of all the plastic waste that we have that everyone sees pictures on Facebook every day. So guess where all that comes from? Coca-Cola and all their people that make all those massive profits for a tiny, tiny amount of executive shareholders and upper management, such as Chairman and CEO James Quincy, who in 2018 was compensated $16.7 million, and the third richest man in the United States, Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway, owns 9.36% of shares, valued at $19 billion. So what a conspiracy theory. Oh, wait. This is how capitalism works. That's our fantastic economic system. So could you tell us more about the unfortunate logical conclusions of capital and how it affects water fountains and forestry?
Yeah, so I'm going to preface this by saying this is all theories. None of this has been proven fact. Don't sue me, Coca-Cola. respond to my email. And so like when the new Forestry Science Center was built, this is all according to an article that Sarah Morrison wrote in 2001 in the UBC. Love the UBC. So the Forestry Science Center was built with no fountains in it. And so somebody said that they thought it was like policy to not install water fountains at UBC, which was not true. There's no policy governing like the amount of water fountains in a building. That was according to the director of planning, Fred Pritchard. And then there was another thing where there is like 17 out of the 18 water fountains in the Scarf building, the education building, were shrouded in plastic and rendered unusable from 1997 to like the mid 2000s.
Wow.
I don't have the exact year that they were brought back to life, but I recently took a trip over there and sure enough, there's like a ton of water fountains there, which is pretty nice to see now.
Okay. Progress.
Yeah, exactly. And so apparently that was because people weren't using the water fountains a lot, according to UBC. And so it had like mineral
allegedly
buildup. Yeah, allegedly it had mineral buildup and it was unsafe for students to drink from. But like they
thank God
them,
we have that
like,
safe alternative Coca-Cola products.
Right. Yeah, like so instead of like fixing the fountains, they just left them for many, many years. And of course, in the Forestry Science Center, there was like a bread garden. Like there was like coffee available. There was Dasani water available. So people are like, this is fishy. Like why are we given water to buy and not water to freely drink from the tap as it naturally occurs in
our well, and now
systems.
All those same neoliberals, a.k.a. people who think that, you know, market logic will solve the problem, are now the same people who I think have crocodile tears for all the plastic waste in this world. I'm like, hello, this was your fault. You know, 33.6 million Coca-Cola products need to be sold. That's a lot of plastic waste.
Yeah, it is.
That's 33.6 million freaking Coke things. So
yeah.
Good work, neoliberals.
Yeah, and they're still trying to sell us that stuff here because, like, there was the Healthy Beverage Initiative that was, like, passed in, I believe, the summer of 2018. And that was, like, they're going to put, like, Coca-Cola, like, Classic on the lower shelves. They're not as advertised. And then put, like, water and stuff on the higher shelves. And, like, there was different tiers. So they were going to mostly eliminate the advertising of, like, the beverages that have added sugar, but then that means like Coke Zero is considered healthy somehow, but it's like no, it's not. It's not healthy. It's still Coca-Cola.
Yeah, how about water?
Yeah, but they're still trying to sell us water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
So they're just still trying to sell us stuff that creates plastic waste. But, you know, we have water fountains now, I guess, but like is that really solving anything?
And
people
we
still buy bottled water.
Yeah, and we still have bottled water. We have plastic waste problems, and we put all the money in the pockets of the executives of Coca-Cola. So, you know, naturally preparing for this, I went down the rabbit hole of, you know, Coca-Cola corporate social responsibility. So looking into the human rights record of Coca-Cola, here's a list of Coca-Cola workers murdered in Colombia. Many more Coke workers or family members have been intimidated, tortured, kidnapped, illegally detained, and or murdered by paramilitaries who have a history of working closely with management. So these are all people in Colombia that were murdered by Coca-Cola because they were trying to unionize their workplace and fight for the rights of workers. So, you know, when you open happiness in those bottles, really you're opening death in the global south. So, you know, there's Avelino Achiknoy, Jose Elizar Manco David, Luis Enrique Geraldo Arango, Luis Enrique Gomez Garando. Wow, that's hard. That's that's tough. Isidoro Segundo Gil, Jose Librado Herrera Osorio, Oscar Dario Sotopolo, Adolfo de Jesus Munera Lopez, Ricardo Ramon Pablo Gomez. So real people that have been murdered just so that Coca-Cola could make absurd profits and destroy the world while doing it and make people very unhealthy by drinking their beverages. So, you know, I think it's important to center human beings in these stories. And, you know, where does all the money come from? Why are their profits so high? Because they murder people who try to, you know, get fair wages for workers. Right. I thought that was important to bring up. Also, I found a video from KillerCoke.org. So this is prefaced as "Sparks fly as Coca-Cola CEO Muhtar Kent looks foolish trying to muzzle corporate campaign Inc. campaign to stop Killer Coke director Ray Rogers from raising issues regarding Coca-Cola work-related fatalities and profiting from illegal dangerous child labor in sugarcane harvesting. So it's pretty intense stuff, but it's also fantastic.
Oh. Coca-Cola advertises itself as promoting happiness and a culture of workplace safety and public well-being. But history and present-day reality paints a somewhat different picture. In 1989, in Alton, Texas, a Coca-Cola truck hit a school bus. 21 children were killed and 49 injured.
Mr. Rogers, you have to stay on topic. Resolution.
Why do people want an opportunity to vote for members of the board so that these kind of things don't get hidden and covered up?
Please.
It's not all happiness out
there. Please present.
Give Mr.
What a savage, Ray Rogers. What do you guys think about that? Do you think the Coca-Cola shareholders should know about all the kids being killed?
Well, I'm sure they were pretty unhappy to hear that.
I feel like a lot of people in corporations in general are in denial about like child labor and supply chains. Like, there's been a lot of investigations into this, including one that Canada Land did, I believe, about Wii.
Yes.
And, like, a bunch of products that Wii, like, brands, and, like, they use, like, palm oil, which involves a lot of, like, child labor, also killing orangutans. it's very weird how people, like, seem to deny or just don't want to hear the realities mm-hmm. of, like, consumer chains and, like, how they impact real people, because it's like we just see it as sugarcane over here, but then like
right.
it's actual people harvesting the sugarcane, actual people being like exploited doing the labor mm-hmm. to make these products.
Yeah, to create the value yeah. for these greedy capitalists just so they can exploit it to put more surplus value that they steal from the workers in their pockets. It's really disgusting stuff. And, you know, it's great that, you know, UBC is doing business with such reputable companies such as Coca-Cola. You know, in the future, I really do want to look into Gildan because that's Canada's largest t-shirt manufacturer, also the world's largest employer of children. Hmm. So, you know, it's good. We're getting people jobs. Bad news, they're all kids. So, you know, right. that's who, you know, this fake progressive institution works with. So, and that's why I try to tell people, you know, like, it's great. You can espouse all the highest ideals. Like, wouldn't it be nice if children weren't being used to make stuff? Yeah, but that would require people to not constantly need to, like, make a profit off of other people's backs. So, I mean, that's something that, you know, liberals at UBC really don't want to wrestle with. And something that, you know, I still take it personally that Santa Ono gave me a dirty look at the Storm the Wall first aid tent. Just for blowing the whistle on the insanity that is this institution and just the cognitive dissonance that these people have. On that note, we're going to take a short break for commercials, but we'll be right back after that.
Am I wrong?
Man, they were nihilists, man.
Huh?
They kept saying they believed in nothing.
Nihilists.
The Great Escape from Nihilism, Rediscovering Our Passion in Late Modernity by Dr. Gordon E. Karkner involves a journey out of the prison of contemporary nihilism and into a meaningful life trajectory. Rooted in the work of Canadian premier philosopher Charles Taylor, this book is a relevant read for students and faculty. You can find it at the UBC or Regent bookstores.
Who's the f***ing nihilist around here, you bunch of f***ing crybabies?
Crimes and Treasons Radio, this is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM with Relly Rails and Jules Andre Brown.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to Spencer Latu Show. I'm your host, Spencer Latu. I'm here with my co-host, Ajit.
What up?
And we're here with special guest Sammy Smart. So we're just spending the last little bit discussing Coca-Cola and UBC's really crappy deal. It was just a way to get their marketing guy. It looks, at least, you know, from what we can see, thanks to the six-year-long battle for freedom of information for this public institution, that, you know, the person that came out the best from this was a marketing guy and the giant corporation Coca-Cola, who is using child labor and abuses human rights. So I just wanted to, you know, play the last little clip of Ray Rogers. So Ray Rogers is the Campaign to Stop Killer Coke director, and he was at the 2015 annual general meeting of shareholders at Coca-Cola, just really laying into the CEO. So this is just one more clip from that.
A truck killed 10 children and 9 of the seriously injured, and to this day I can't find out how that turned out. In 2014, in Carlstead, New Jersey, you published a safety culture feedback report. There is a reminder to open happiness at the front door of the Kahlstedt location. It is an aspiration that does not appear to be actualized. Workers there in Kahlstedt say there is little happiness. Rather, they report anger and frustration. The majority perceive Kahlstedt as a broken culture characterized by a lack of caring and unrealistic expectations, deadlines, and goals. The overall safety culture score for Kahlstedt is a 2.88, placing it as a strong negative culture.
So that's Ray Rogers giving it to the Coca-Cola shareholders. I couldn't help but think, was he describing Coca-Cola facility or the University of British Columbia? I really, when he said that anger and frustration and, impossible deadlines to make and pressure from people, I was thinking, you know what? Sounds a lot like my experience here, too.
Lack of mental health support systems.
Yeah, yeah. No shortage of really ridiculous virtue signaling and, money being made by horrible marketers. Sammy, any closing thoughts on Coca-Cola and UBC?
Don't sue me. That's what I'd like. I'm really happy about all the people that have reported on it over the years, because most of my material for the historical part of that article was like pieces that were in the archives that of all the UBC issues from 1995 till now. And I'm really thankful for all the reporting on it that was done from the beginning, because they really made it possible for this story to like be revived, because it seems we forget about it. And I've talked to a lot of people that said they had no idea this agreement existed. They had no idea about everything that had happened, and apparently me talking about it made them very interested. There's even a former professor, I believe, of the mathematics department that has a page on his personal website about Coca-Cola deals and links my article in his page, and it's like, wow. I'm a
Dr. Guseb?
No, Kellogg something. I can't remember.
Okay, that's awesome.
But yeah, I've had my 15 minutes of fame from this article.
No, you didn't have your first. You are a big J journalist, shedding light and speaking truth to power. So we're very happy to have you. Thank you so much for all the work that you've done. I think it's really important for people to know, why there's so many more vending machines.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people just try to accept things and pretend that it's not a political battle that's constantly raging at UBC, and that people who give a shit about politics are stupid. But in reality, you're stupid, because politics is why, we have, Dasani everywhere and plastic everywhere, and the world's getting all screwed up. So, take that, apolitical jerks. Boom. Okay, so here's another hyper-local issue within our own student nest. So, when I was running for student union president, I came across many different groups on campus, and one group that I wanted to get in contact was Muslim students, because in my opinion, at least, I really think that in our world there's been a drastic ramp up of, xenophobia, Islamophobia, not just since 9/11, but also since the Syrian refugee crisis, and that, it's starting to trickle into UBC. And, I see people with really retrograde views on Islam that repeat the same horrible talking points on, UBC pages talking about Muslim students, and just the general, disdain people have for Islam here. And it came to my attention that for Muslims who pray five times daily, which there's 10,000 of them on campus, so that's quite the constituency, right. Probably more than Coca-Cola drinkers, so let's try to figure out where our priorities lie. The 10,000 students here at a public institution, so it should serve the public, which is 10,000 people, and they only had one place to pray, and that was in Brock Hall Annex. So that was a building built in the 1950s, and it was a tiny unventilated space where not everyone could fit in there, and they'd have to go pray in the hallway. And that kind of shattered my heart, because I was thinking, these people who are, just engaging in, I would hope in our free society to, engage in whatever religion they want to. And, they feel a sense of community and belonging from it. And they're being deprived at UBC. But, thank goodness we have a climbing wall. We have, tons of space for the travel agency, the wireless wave we have in here. But no space for students who want to express their religion.
Right. We have Dasani water for them to do voodoo with.
Yeah, there you go. There's some, you know, and they didn't have a sink before. We'll get to that later. So they could have just used some Dasani bottled water. So luckily, there is some improvement in this story. So that's why we're bringing this up. The headline from the UBC reads, students see primarily prose in temporary Muslim prayer space. So this is written by Zubair Hirji and Emma Livingstone of the UBC. This was posted May 1st, 2019. Shouts out May Day. Shouts out to all the fellow Reds that were protesting on May Day. That was awesome. So back to the article. Over the recent exam period, the UBC Equity and Inclusion Office added temporary prayer space for Muslim students on campus in the West Mall swing space. This room was in addition to a 24-hour space in Brock Hall Annex and a space in Marine Drive Residence that is only open on Fridays. The West Mall space was created in response for multiple requests from students for more prayer space on the west side of campus. Students who spoke with the UBC welcomed the additional space. It's closer to where I usually have class, said mining engineering student Farhaz Ahmed, and it worked out pretty well, during exam season especially. In addition to simply providing an extra place for students to pray, the temporary space is more comfortable to pray in. Afan Bandakia, a Muslim Students Association executive, said the new space had more ventilation in comparison to that of Brock Hall. The space also included a sink for students to use and was more organized. The temporary space was also more accessible for students with mobility restrictions, as it was located near a wheelchair-accessible building. In contrast, the Brock Hall Annex does not include accessible entryways for students with mobility restrictions. So obviously very depressing that there is so little space for them on campus, but this is good. I'm happy they have the sink. That's a, you know, something to celebrate. And I think that, you know, I catch myself that doing this is that, you know, I can't help but, I kind of gloss over, you know, the struggle people do that have disabilities. You know, people with disabilities go through a lot, and I'm trying to push myself to more think about accessibility and how to, you know, combat ableism, because I think ableism is, you know, a really underdeveloped part of social justice, and, you know, how to really help people is through ableism. Do you have any thoughts on this, Ajit?
No, I mean, it's good that this temporary arrangement was made, but I think the key term is that it's temporary. So I think maybe moving forward, as we're going to see in the article, that the students are actually looking to kind of get something more permanent established.
Yeah, we're celebrating a small victory here. Keyword small. And so back to the article. Despite many pros, so such as having a space rather than having just one poorly ventilated place, the students also expressed a few concerns, a few minor things that are wrong with the West Mall swing space. For instance, it does not take into consideration cultural aspects like the lack of space for ablution, a place for cleaning hands and feet before prayer, which is available at Brock Hall Annex. Students were also under the impression that it would become a permanent fixture for community use when the space was first proposed to them. They tried to increase their usage of it to show UBC administration that a demand was present. What we thought was that if we use it more often, we'd receive a permanent prayer space, and we use it to the best of our ability, said Bandakia. Students added that the space has become crowded during the Friday prayers and can create a fire hazard with people blocking doorways. That prayer specifically is obligatory for Muslims and the Muslim community, and since there's a huge population of people coming in, it becomes a fire hazard for people outside. Equity and Inclusion, the UBC office responsible for the prayer space, said it was aware of the need for more prayer space. We knew the demand for additional space was high, and we worked with campus partners to address the needs, said Tracy Weidman, Director of Partnerships and Organizational Strategy at Equity Inclusion, in a statement to the UBC. When asked about the issues of overcrowding and the potential fire hazard, Weidman said the office is working toward a solution. We understand that the prayer space in Brock Hall Annex is regularly and highly used by students, and that there is a need for additional campus space. We are actively working to address various prayer space needs with campus partners, including Muslim student groups. Generally, all the students the UBC spoke to regarding the new space were very happy to have a new space, even after considering any drawbacks. There's a lot of pros and cons, Bandakia said. Primarily pros for the West Mall swing space. So, wow. What a messed up situation. And this is what really pisses me off about the fake progressiveness, is that, you know, we live in a world where Islamic people are under full attack, whether it's in the political realm with people, you know, creating their entire, you know, presidential campaign like Donald Trump on demonizing Muslims. Or then you have, you know, Maxime Bernier doing the same thing in Canada, Andrew Scheer and the Conservatives to a lesser extent, and all these people like crying about Sharia law, whatever that is. And, you know, UBC has just a layup of an opportunity.
Right. And I think in an indirect way, this is also related with mental health, because I feel like a lot of religious people, like myself included, find that, you know, prayer is a good way to deal with stress, especially during exam time or, you know, whenever really. So having this space is really nice because a lot of us forget that maybe I think the closest mosque, I'd assume, is East Van. I don't think there's anything on West Side. And, you know, that
weird.
Right. And like,
maybe due to the wily white gentrifying population.
Right. I mean, and that's just, I mean, that's just facts of history. Right. That's like, so I think it's important for UBC. As you said, there's a massive Muslim population and among also other religious minorities, which don't get afforded this. You know, I know we have multiple churches on campus. Right. And ones which are really close. So it's nice that, you know, practicing Christians or people who may take their faith a bit more seriously, they have that resource. So it's just I think this is a good gesture for the time being, but they notice that it's really busy, and like it's gonna only get busier, you know, during certain, there's an overlap during, I think, Ramadan. I know the calendar is always shifting, so, you know, it's gonna ramp up during then. So I think having a bit more permanent thing, or maybe some sort of arrangement or a bigger space. I know we got these giant halls up in the Nest, which could become really useful too. So we got tons of space. I think we could make it work.
It absolutely should not be this hard to find a space for people to pray in that's right. Safe. You should not have to think about fire hazards while you're doing your prayers. That's absolutely insane to me. Like, my God, though when I go to church, I am a little bit scared because it fills up with like incense smoke. Somebody like faints every time I go to church. General Orthodox things. But you know what? We asked for the fire hazard, but they don't. This is so screwed up. Like, they shouldn't have to worry about that when they're praying. It's like, that's your safe space. You shouldn't have to fear like something bad happening, like overcrowding and fire hazards and like.
Yeah,
especially,
like just basic humanity things, like exactly. Not having to worry about, because, you know, they brought it up. So clearly everyone's thinking like, you know what, this is not good, because what if some like horrible white supremacists from, you know, the UBC Free Speech Club or, you know, all the really gross people on our campus that write horrible things about Muslim people all the time publicly, do it out in the open. They just don't care. You know, so if anyone wants to go look on UBC Free Speech Club's Facebook group, you know, to show that there's no Islamic, anti-Islam stuff on there. But, you know, these people, they saw what happened in Christchurch. They know how these white supremacists feel about them, and it's only getting worse. So, you know, the least UBC could do, you know, which they condemned the attack, you know, and they can, and they say how much they care about, you know, Muslims, yet here we are. In a way, you could easily materially help them. You could, right then and there, you know, make some space for them. Right. You know, we have more than enough space on campus. You know, we've already stolen it from the Musqueam people, so we might as well do something good with it, mm-hmm. you know, at this point. And they can't even do that.
Mm-hmm. Give them a sink.
Yeah, a right. sink, you know, maybe a place so they can actually do what they're supposed to be doing in there. But here we are. And, you know, I just and for it to challenge all the leftists out there, you know, like, I think that, you know, organizing with, you know, our Islamic comrades is like super important. Because, you know, who's really eating it in imperialism right now? You know, the Middle East is where, you know, all the countries are fighting for space.
Right.
They're all trying to take over, you know, and create larger, you know, larger areas of control for them. So, and who's suffering for it domestically and abroad?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people of the Muslim faith.
Right.
And the least you could do is show some solidarity and just be like, yeah, they shouldn't have to, you know, go into an unventilated space and pray in the hallways.
Right, and they're not even, I think they're trying to escape from, you know, the horrors of reality in moments like this. So again, right, making them as, providing as safe of an environment as possible is the best.
Providing any environment at this point.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, you know, yeah, we stepped it up to one room with a fire hazard.
Yeah Brock Hall, not the most welcoming environment in like mm-hmm. a That's structural horrifying. Sense. Yeah.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, Muslim girls used to have to pray in the washroom because that's where the sink was. That was the only private space to pray. And I'd like go in there at lunch hour and they'd be like washing their hands like up to their elbows. And it's like, you should have a space to be able to do this. Like, I had a lot of Muslim students at my high school and like they did not have a space to do that. I think things may have changed in the last like how many years has it been since I was there? But like, If we can only give people like a crappy place in the West Mall swing space that's like that bad? Is it that much of a step up from a bathroom?
Yeah, no, it really isn't. That's a really good thing you point out there. And, you know, I think it's just like a larger societal problem that we have where, you know, we pretend that like, oh, all it's either, you know, it's this either or where it's like, oh, we accept all religions, a.k.a. we accept Christianity. Or it's like, oh, we don't like religion anymore, a.k.a. demonize Islam. Like, that's basically the two. You know, and either way, Islamic people are eating it. You know, they're suffering for no reason whatsoever. It's not like they did anything to anybody, yet here they are, right? And I just think that, you know, and it doesn't have to be like, you know, just for Muslim students. It could be for all students. You know, all students of religious, you know, make a, you know, maybe let's, you know, use the space in where the Christians have. Seems like, you know, there's a, you know, they got tons of space. So, you know, it'd be really cool, you know, if they helped out other people of other faiths as well.
Right. Mm.
You know,
definitely. How many Protestant churches are there on campus?
Yeah, do we need another, you know? could we just, you know, share one of them maybe?
Yeah, like Little Mosque on the Prairie, how it was like half church, half mosque. Do that kind of thing at
Interfaith
least.
Solidarity.
Exactly.
That's exactly what we need.
The same God.
Seriously, there it is. And Jesus is part of Islam. There he is. He's mm-hmm. right then and there.
Right.
Yeah, it's really disappointing, but not, you know, and once again, fake progressive institution, really fake. And you know, if they could just, I feel like they have to keep up the fakeness because if people saw this for what it is, which is like this horrific, you know, exploitative place that doesn't give two shits about its students.
Right.
People would demand a change, so they have to do that crap where Santa Ono goes, yeah, let's clap it up for survivors at the beginning of Imagine Day, and they don't even provide services to these people, to quote-unquote survivors that they love so much. Mm-hmm. You know, they acknowledge Islam exists when 50 of them die.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's disgusting.
Only when push comes to shove, right?
Yeah, and even then, it's still more just like pandering and other horrible behavior by our horrible university. So we're going to have to take a short break for commercials, but we'll be right back after that.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Miranda Filmic is best thought of as an introversal jukebox which has no concept of genre, style, political boundaries, or even space-time relevance. But it does know good sounds from bad. Lately, the program has been focused on Philip Random's All Vinyl Countdown plus Apocalypse, the 1111th greatest records you probably haven't heard. And we're not afraid of noise. Miranda Filmic, every Saturday at 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm your host, Spencer Latu. I'm here with my co-host, Ajit.
Salam.
And we're joined with our special guest, Sammy Smart, for the rest of the hour and a half that we have. Hello, Sammy.
Shalom.
Good to see you all. Thank you for embracing your religious faiths. I, unfortunately, am not very... I did go to religious school. That gives me some cred.
Yeah.
I pretended for a couple of years. Anyways.
What's the greeting for state-sponsored atheism?
Hello, comrade.
Niet. So, okay.
Privyet.
Yeah. Speaking of socialism, anti-imperialism. So this is unfortunately the most. I wasn't fully around. You know, I was only 10 years old, so I couldn't really grasp the Iraq War and the lead up to the Iraq War. But now that I'm aware, watching the U.S., Canada, EU, just the entire NATO. Military-industrial complex, propaganda machine at work preparing and manufacturing consent for this Venezuelan regime change operation has been nothing but fascinating. So, Ajit, how have you been finding the media coverage for the Venezuela issue?
Very partisan, you could say, one-sided, demonizing the incumbent, Maduro. I think they already got their flag set in whichever camp they're on. I think there's really very little reporting on their perspective. It's just that he's a gross human rights violator. Inflation is horribly rampant, and of course people are suffering, right? So then, but they're just exploiting people suffering that I don't think they really care about at the end of the day. Just
really, because I can tell you a bunch of Muslims that are suffering on campus that you could help them right away,
right?
For all the people that are, you know, and even I just couldn't believe some white Venezuelan would write some crap in the UBC, you know, begging regime change. This will be my other pet project, to go through UBC archives and look to see if there's any Iraq war pushers.
Well, I mean, if you could afford to go to here, it's pretty obvious what socioeconomic strata.
Yeah, you're probably not one of the people lifted out of poverty by Hugo Chavez. So, to say the least, you're not living in one of the communes, which is why they hate these people so much. So, G, you mentioned earlier it's very one-sided. So, there's fairness and accuracy in reporting are fair. Amazing media critics. Everyone should listen to their podcast, as well as check out Citations Needed by Adam Johnson and Nima Shirazi. Fantastic podcast as well. So, if you go on FAIR's website, there's an article there. Posted April 30th, 0% of elite commentators oppose regime change in Venezuela. A FAIR survey of U.S. opinion journalism on Venezuela found no voices in elite corporate media that opposed regime change in that country. Over a three-month period, January 15th to April 15th, zero opinion pieces in the New York Times or Washington Post took an anti-regime change or pro-Maduro Chavista position. Not a single commentator on the big three Sunday morning talk shows or PBS NewsHour came out against President Nicolas Maduro stepping down from the Venezuelan government.
What, the liberal media?
Yeah, the liberal bias. That's why I kind of like, I can't help but laugh at the really ridiculous right wingers that pretend that there's some kind of like leftist conspiracy in the media, of the fake news media. Right. No, they're on your side, guys. You guys are just really stupid and racist. That's it. So, Sammy, what's been your take from seeing Venezuelan media about Venezuela?
Well, I've pretty much like, I don't read the New York Times because I have no money. And
incognito mode. That's how you beat the five. Yeah.
Oh my God, you're right. I should start doing that for the New Yorker too.
Power to the people.
God, I got that subscription for 12 weeks. Anyway, I did it for the tote bag. Anyway, okay. I feel like I get all of my news from leftist Twitter and our Chapo Trap House on Reddit. So like, I don't actually see that many liberal takes because I like purposefully don't look at them.
Right.
Like I don't follow like any centrist or liberal things on Twitter other than like liberal. Alyssa Milano.
Yeah.
So like, I see a lot of criticism, luckily, for like imperialist, like I guess tampering with the government and. I luckily see a lot of critical takes, but that's only because I'm like in a bubble, like a really leftist bubble.
Yeah, yeah. You need to. It's the only sane one, because as we're going to go deconstruct the CBC article, there's a lot of things that they kind of just sneak in there, and they let the language do the work for you. They do the thinking for you. They just tell you what to think, and this is what we mean by manufacturing consent. Shouts out to Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman for that fantastic piece. So this is how the corporate media, you know, we pretend that we live in a fair, free democracy. We really don't. And this whole Venezuela crisis really just shows people how the media is not, you know, the people, you know, that are the hawks of truth out there. They are, in fact, hawks of war. So except for our investigative independent journalists like Sammy Smart, she's cool. But the people in the Associated Press, CBC, Washington Post, New York Times, PBS NewsHour, even all hawks. So here's how this article started on April 30th. So we got the news in the morning that there was a coup happening in Venezuela. So the title of this article is Maduro is prepared to leave Venezuela, U.S. Secretary of State. Opposition leader Juan Guaido revives bid to oust president, resulting in protests and clashes. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Nicolas Maduro was prepared to leave Venezuela Tuesday morning in the face of a call for an uprising by opposition leader Juan Guaido, but reversed his plan after Russia intervened. Pompeo made the statement in an interview on CNN. They had an airplane on the tarmac. He was ready to leave this morning. As we understand it, Russians indicated he would stay. Wow, that's a lot there. So, but we have the words of Nicolas Maduro himself. I thought this was a really great and hilarious clip.
They Mike Pompeo this afternoon said, Maduro has a plane ready to flee to Cuba, and the Russians took him off the plane and forbade him from leaving the country. Mr. Pompeo, please, are you serious?
Long live Maduro and Chavez. Awesome. That was great. So there's a lot packed in there. So we see just the usual, uncritically repeating what the military-industrial complex has to say about a situation. You know, obviously there's no criticism of what Mike Pompeo had to say and the obvious insanity of it of, you know, where would this plane go? And why would this guy leave his country as the president? And it just seems that it was more feeding into the liberal narrative that, you know, there's this crisis and the world is burning in Venezuela. Also, maybe a little bit of a nod to Russiagate.
Right.
Ajit, any thoughts?
Well, not exactly related to the question you're saying, but it is an interesting parallel because you mentioned Iraq earlier. And I think one of the societal conditions, what we noticed, you could say the zeitgeist in the lead up to the Iraq War, is it's also taking place right now. There's this like this rampant, really strong right wing narrative in the mainstream, or not necessarily the mainstream, but among large segments of the population. Another thing is the economy is doing really good. And when the economy is doing really good, you want to go to war then, because you can't go to war. I mean, it's not really good because there's massive amounts of debt, mm-hmm. but in terms of real estate prices, in terms of the stock market, in terms of, you know, the wallets of those people in power, it's a really good time to, you know, expend some value, right? And you don't spend $700 billion on a military for it to do nothing. You got to use it once in a while. So I think that's kind of the lead up into this. It's, and the way that they're framing Venezuela, you know, absent the WMDs, it's the same thing that they framed Saddam with, you know, this...
Maduro's a dictator.
Right, and he, you know, harbors narco-terrorists, massive human rights violator.
Which is funny because Colombia is right next to it, which is doing that, and that's a U.S. ally, so.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm noticing. And again, who failed us the most in the lead-up to Iraq? It was the media, and it's the same thing here, so.
Yeah, and the narco-terrorists were also CIA-trained people. So that's a very, you know, it's very, you know, when you interrogate these things for more than 10 seconds, they really seem to fall to pieces. Sammy, did you follow Russiagate at all?
Russiagate isn't like the Russian collusion stuff?
Yes.
I mean, a little. My parents watched a lot of CNN for a while because they didn't have anything better to do. So, like, I unfortunately know a lot about, like, Don Lemon's takes on it and, God. Like, Cuomo's takes.
Do you see a little bit of a hint towards that? Like, you know, how they kind of... Because that's why I said the danger of Russiagate was, and all the idiot leftists that, you know, really went onto this conspiracy theory, because, you know, this is just going to be used as a... You know, they're going to tie anybody that the U.S. doesn't like, whether it be, you know, environmentalists, they're going to be Russian puppets, or, you know, third parties are going to be, you know, influenced by Russia. And now it's, you know, look at Maduro. He's a dictator that also is working with Vladimir Putin, you know, and like that's, you know, that's why I think it was just such a dangerous conspiracy theory, because now look at it. You know, it's being used as this is newsworthy, something that never happened. But since, you know, the media uncritically repeats it.
Yeah, it's like the Red Scare 2.0. Like, am I going to start being called a commie by, like, my classmates? Oh, 3.0,
1917, right. Woodrow Wilson had one.
Okay, yeah, I guess that was the first Red Scare. But I'm more so referring to the one that my mom lived through.
Oh, no.
Because she's Slavic. Her parents didn't speak English. Grew up during the 60s and 70s here. Mm. Got called a commie all the time. Got made fun of because her parents didn't speak English.
Wow, not much has changed here, hey?
Yeah, no. I highly doubt I'm going to be a victim, because the only thing that outs me as being Slavic is, like, my nose and a necklace I wear sometimes. But, like, it's just so weird that we just keep on going back to Russia. It's like, calm down.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, some Russians are scary. Like, but, like, what about, like, the Macedonian teenage trolls that were, like, trying to get, like, revenue from clicks that made, like, a fake news website? It's like, why aren't we talking about, like, Macedonian trolls and Macedonian
Or how about collusion? The CIA sock puppets? You know, they admitted to spending millions of dollars to influence people online through CIA operations, yet no one seems to give a shit about that. Because, you know, once again, we're letting, you know, you say Russia and then boom, it does all the thinking for you, which is why I think this
perpetual
language is...
Perpetual boogeyman.
It's, you know, this is the fifth filter of manufacturing consent, the common enemy, right? So this is like, oh my God, not only are they socialists, nihilists, which is scary enough for the American with a 10-minute attention span. Now Vladimir Putin is involved, so you know this hardcore capitalist oligarch, you know, guy mm-hmm. now is working with the Reds. Okay,
doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, but that's how usually mainstream media goes. So
yeah,
but they're white. So yeah, why don't right wingers like them? And I think they do because of that.
Yeah, no, and I think
that's an interesting, you know, just throwing that out there.
Yeah, it's, and also, you know, let's think about this for a second. So in Russia, they're oligarchs, and here in Canada and the United States, philanthropists. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
quite the PR spin zone we got going on here. So, so that's that one tidbit of information that got a lot of play. That whole Russia Maduro thing was very popular. And another, you know, thing that gets thrown around a lot that is never talked about is my least favorite character, Leopoldo Lopez. So we're gonna go back to the article. In a surprise, Leopoldo Lopez, Juan Guaido's political mentor. So who is Juan Guaido? He is the opposition leader, and he is the CIA puppet. And I say that because, you know, he met with the CIA. He went to George Washington University. He's an American-educated man. You know, the coup started after he met with Pompeo. Sorry, got on the phone with Pompeo. Sorry, not Pompeo. Sorry, Mike Pence, the other evil white guy in the Trump administration. And Mike Pence puts out that horrible Twitter video, "We are with you, Venezuela," and then boom, the coup begins. So once again, this is all U.S. U.S. staged, and the people who really believe that it's a popular uprising of the Venezuelan people, you know, probably look at some footage of it for yourselves. Look at some independent journalists such as Max Blumenthal and Ben Norton at the Gray Zone Project. You know, you can see him. We see Max Blumenthal walking through a mall asking people, "Where's the communism? You know, where's the food shortages?" Because it's not how it works there. It's the $30 million a day of U.S. sanctions, $30 million a day, that are causing the problems there.
Right.
So I don't really, you know, I haven't had a liberal explain to me how that doesn't factor into things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, that could be a problem.
What is that about? Like $11 billion a year in sanctions?
Yeah. And it's not allowing Venezuela to make money off the oil that they sell because the U.S. is blocking them from doing that.
So they're not importing their oil.
They can't take the money out of it. They're locked out of the bank accounts because of the United States, which is, you know, I think criminal considering how many people don't have medicine or food now because of that.
Right.
And that they almost declared war over the $10 million aid package, which was weapons, they found out anyway, and was set on fire by U.S.
Right. It's exact another parallel with Iraq.
Yeah, they false flags.
They constructed the conditions which are a precursor to them invading.
Yep. And the sanctions in Iraq killed 500,000 children, and Madeleine Albright said it was worth the price. So, yeah, she's rehabilitated by the mainstream media as well. All these ghouls never seem to go away. And so to get back to my least favorite character other than Juan Guaido, Leopoldo Lopez. So this is the political mentor of Juan Guaido, the CIA puppet, and the nation's most prominent opposition activist, according to the Associated Press, and put it in CBC. He's an opposition activist, stood alongside him, detained in 2014 for leading a previous round of anti-government unrest. Lopez said he had been released from house arrest by security forces and adhering to an order from Guaido. "I want to tell the Venezuelan people, this is the moment to take to the streets and accompany these patriotic soldiers," Lopez declared. "Everyone should come to the streets in peace." So, problem with that statement, they were armed to the teeth. They had assault rifles in the streets, so it's kind of awkward that you'd be saying that, Leopoldo. Anyway, so if we do some little bit of digging, so we can find out some very interesting things about Leopoldo Lopez. So this is the case of Leopoldo Lopez. A Venezuelan judge sentenced far-right opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez to 13 years and 9 months in prison Thursday evening for his role in leading last year's violent government protests. This was in 2014. Venezuelan judge Susana Barrios found Lopez guilty of public incitement to violence and association to commit crimes. In particular, the judge cited over 700 tweets, which she says urged supporters to take to the streets to demand the exit of democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. Beginning on February 12, 2014, and lasting several months, the protests saw opposition supporters set up violent street barricades that led to the deaths of 43 people, over half of whom were security personnel and passersby. Lopez was arrested on February 14th after clashes saw armed opposition backers attack the public prosecutor's office and other government buildings, leading to several deaths and widespread public property damage. So let me pose this to my co-host and a special guest. What would happen if Bernie Sanders put out 700 tweets about the exit of democratically elected President Donald Trump and did all the shit that this guy did? What would happen to Bernie and the Bernie bros, the Bernie army?
They would make them eat rats.
Yeah, I mean, arrested for treason, right?
Do you think they get arrested? Or do you think they would just get...
It'd be a good opportunity to shoot him, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm like, you know, that's why I'm saying this whole case of Leopoldo Lopez is kind of like, so you lived after doing all this stuff. You shot up, you know, the Venezuelan equivalent of the district attorney's office.
Right.
And you killed, over half of whom, so 20 or so cops, and you lived to tell the tale.
Well, I mean, I think Maduro is well aware of the pressure he's under, right? So I think
this is a very strange dictatorship that this guy's still alive.
Right. Well,
I've never seen someone who lived after killing 20 cops.
Right, but I think Maduro, he would understand if you did such a move that could be clear justification for somebody like the United States to
who's looking for an excuse to invade. Right. That's been creating a bullshit propaganda.
And I think the only
campaign.
Reason they're not is because of Russia, right? So.
Russia and China. Shouts out China for keeping the hands off Venezuela.
It's the Cold War still?
It is. This is the new Cold War here where it's, you know, it's...
Never ended, though.
No. And it's just all this NATO garbage. Sammy, what do you think? What do you think would happen?
Well, I just want to say that, like, I think if this is happening in any country where somebody doesn't get shot on site for, like, killing cops... They're living in the extended cinematic GTA universe, like where you have 5 stars, and you just run away for 2 minutes and it goes away and you're fine.
He's using the cheat code of calling the CIA to overthrow the government.
Exactly. Like the regime changed cheat code. He just like flew away from the cops and everything's fine. His stars went away. He's totally okay.
Right. So he was on house arrest. I know people. Eric Garner was choked to death for selling loose cigarettes.
Right.
This motherfucker was on house arrest. And that's what just bothers me with this whole Maduro's a dictator line. Like, not only did Venezuela have more elections than any other country on planet Earth, the guy that is the leading, you know, coup leader, regime change pusher, not only is not, you know, in solitary confinement, which, you know, there's more people that sold that, you know, possess marijuana in America. They're in solitary confinement. More people with mental illnesses. In prison, and then this guy who's committing political crimes, as Amnesty International reported, they're politically motivated. I wonder why. And he's fine. Also, fun note about Lopez: he was born into Venezuela's wealthiest families. He played an active role in the U.S.-sponsored 2002 coup under George W. Bush, which saw Hugo Chavez briefly ousted from office. Then, in I think it was 70 hours later or so, that the people of Venezuela rose up against the U.S.-backed coup and put Hugo Chavez back into power. So that's awesome. Shouts out, power to the people.
How infuriated. Do you think the neocons are? Because this is happening to their backyard, right?
Yes, the Monroe Doctrine has been tarnished.
Right.
Which I'm pretty sure that John Bolton openly acknowledged. He cited the Monroe Doctrine.
Right, which has nothing to do with... Right, I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's crazy. Yeah, so he's a Harvard-educated lawyer, Leopoldo Lopez. And so... They call the right wing this crazy, you know, maniac terrorist guy. The mainstream media is so crazy. They call him, and once again to quote you, CBC, they call him an opposition activist. That's what he gets called in the mainstream media, and other mainstream media compare him to Gandhi and Mandela.
Wow. Opposition activist. That's the current euphemism?
I used to play on the football team, okay? And I figured this out. So everyone in the mainstream media, it took me 7 years to get my history degree, okay? Everyone in the mainstream media, actually then again, what's that guy from the sources thing on CNN? What's that really, really silly looking guy's name?
Smirkunish?
No. I'm going to look him up. He's really stupid. Anyways.
John Kane?
No.
Jake Tapper?
No, not Jake Tapper, but the other guy.
Wolf Blitzer?
No. Okay, never mind. Anyways, one of the hosts on CNN doesn't even have a degree. So I was just like, you don't have one university degree.
Right.
And you're on CNN.
You're just presentable for the camera.
Yeah.
That's all you really have to
do. And that's what I'm trying to say about these people. Like, they're just, they're all frauds. I have nothing kind of say about these people. Sammy, any thoughts on the state of the mainstream media?
I want CNN to hire a socialist. I want Don Lemon to go full communist on the air. I really like Don Lemon, surprisingly, and I want him to go full communist.
I'll send him a copy of the manifesto. So we're gonna have to take a short commercial break. We'll be right back after that.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursday 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to Spencer Latu's show on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
Hello, hello.
And my special guest, Sammy Smart from the UBC.
Hello.
So we'll just wrap up with a short little discussion about the polls. So, Ajit, what happened in the polls lately for the Canadian federal parties?
Yeah, I mean, I was just watching, I think, it was actually on Twitter, saw like a CTV clip that the current polling data shows that if the public were asked to vote today, I think 40% would vote conservative and liberals were at 27%. And I think that's, I haven't checked the swing from the most previous poll, but it, from what I understand, it is a major reduction in what it was. And I think NDP were somewhere at 12 or 13%. And interestingly, the Green Party was at 11%. And what's the People's Party of Canada? They were, I think, what most of those, marginal super, well, not super, but right, like right wing parties get, which is like 5-6%. But yeah, so not looking good for Mr. Justin Bieber. I mean, Justin Trudeau. So
yeah, he gets roasted on The Simpsons. Boom! Then his numbers go down.
Right,
Sammy. Any thoughts on the current political climate in Canada?
I didn't think it would come to this. I thought that we had learned from the regime of Stephen Harper that the Conservative Party is terrible for us. And I'm really disappointed to see the NDP polling so low because, like, their leadership is actually really charismatic right now. And all I ever see is just like pessimism about them. And like, I personally believe that all politicians are bad. And if you want to get elected, you're a bad person. But like, I think that out of all of the mainstream candidates, Jagmeet Singh seems like he would actually be like a progressive leader in Canada, which is like kind of a first, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So it's really disheartening to see them polling so low. And I thought they might be doing better. At least in my leftist bubble, everybody likes him for the most part compared to the others. But like, it's really bizarre to see like reality is totally different from what's going on in my little head.
Yeah, it's that really you know, it was a shock when not everyone loves Vladimir Lenin. That was a big letdown. But yeah, as far as Jagmeet Singh's concerned, in my personal opinion, it's the issue is, and always has been with the NDP, is that they get something good going for them. You know, they notice that, yeah, when we start talking left, you know, we start sounding like Bernie Sanders and we start sounding like social democratic, like real social democratic right. parties or, you know, actual socialist parties in other parts of the world, you know, they do really well. And then they run to the center as soon as they do that because they think that they're going to lose like this imaginary, you know, white working class, you know,
the middle class.
Yeah, white middle class voter that's sympathetic but knows what's good for them. Knows what's good for their economic interests. This just this fairy tale person.
Right.
And it's, you know, and if we're going to talk about the working class is majority female, majority people of color. Mm-hmm. So why don't we have a party that reflects that? But instead they're constantly looking for these white votes that don't exist and they're only ever going to go to the Conservative Party and at best the federal Liberals.
Right. I think it's important to keep in mind that we are still many months away from the actual election. I think they said it's going to take place in September. And if you look at polling trends, they tend to fluctuate a lot. And then there's usually these large gaps. And the closer you get, the more they converge. So, of course, this is kind of on par for what the media tells us, which is half of it's bullshit anyways. But Yeah, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. Andrew Scheer actually knocked on my door a few weeks ago.
Kind of personally?
Yeah, he was with the guy who's running for in the riding. They want those Punjabi voters.
Right? Andrew Scheer does work hard. When he was the immigration minister for Stephen Harper, ironically enough, the anti-immigrant guy. Yeah. No, sorry. Oh, no. Andrew Scheer himself. Sorry, I was thinking Jason Kenney for a second. Yeah. So Andrew Scheer was at your door.
Yeah, with the guy who's running for a conservative MP. He's competing for it. Oh, because I'm in a liberal riding. And yeah. Surrey's heavily liberal, as most of BC is.
Those conservatives, they do work hard, though. Richmond, deep conservative.
Super conservative. Really? I had to vote strategically in 2015. It was like my first election I could ever vote in. And I really wanted to vote NDP because I didn't really have good feelings about my liberal MP, Joe Pesci Salido, because he used to be a conservative.
Yeah, he's terrible.
Yeah. And so, like, I really wanted to vote NDP because, like, the NDP candidate, I can't remember his name for the life of me, seemed really nice and, like, really genuine. But it's like, oh, I have to vote for Joe because otherwise, like, if we don't vote strategically, we're going to have another conservative. And we know that they are not going to be thinking about the little guy.
Okay. Let me provoke you on this one, Sammy. Okay. So we tried the strategic voting. Mm-hmm. It blew up in our face. It looks like we're, you know, faster in a quarter of the time that Stephen Harper is in power. We're about to get another right-wing government. Can we put to rest the lesser of two evils and strategically voting forever?
I don't know. Everything sucks. Do we even really live in a democracy?
No, we're in an oligarchy, that's for sure. But yeah. can we agree that, or are we at a place that voting strategically does not help?
I mean, yeah, it doesn't really mitigate a whole lot of damage, but like, I don't know. I'm never
going to vote strategically ever again. Well, that's what I'm saying.
What do you define as voting strategically?
So in 2015, if you're in a swing riding, you know, even if you're anywhere on the left, you were demanded to vote liberal because the liberals had the best chance of unseating the Harper government. So we all got behind the federal liberals in that election. So no matter, you know, any blue will do.
How do we think the Greens are going to do in this upcoming election? I think they got a good chance to pick up. What do they have? One seat right now?
Yeah, they've.
Yeah, Saanich, I think.
Yeah, I think.
So Saanich.
Saanich, Victoria.
I think Vancouver Island could be all green. I think there's a high possibility.
Absolutely. In the
provincial election, they got 16% of the vote.
Yeah.
Only three seats, the three key seats that, you know, obviously gave the NDP power provincially. I just think that, you know, people are sick and tired of both parties. So right. I think that they both have a chance. But, you know, I just will never, ever cast a vote for the federal liberals. No one can ever make me do that again.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't in 2015. I did not vote strategically.
Ooh, you gotta do spicy. It for people kind.
Yeah. For people, yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, oh, we do it for climate change. Oh, that didn't happen. Yeah. He bought a pipeline. Oh, we're supposed to do it for voter for to change the voting system. Get rid of first past the post. Yeah, nope, none of that. Oh, we're gonna do it for Indigenous people. An Indigenous woman was literally beat up in front of Justin Trudeau, and mm-hmm. he didn't do anything about it.
But think about if Stephen Harper was, if Stephen Harper was reelected, he probably would have joined in.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that could radicalize enough of the proletarians.
Oh, good point. Yeah. Hot take.
I don't know what's more unlikely, Justin Trudeau helping regular people or socialist revolution in Canada. I haven't, you know, which one is less likely to happen?
God.
Yeah. I think we all know.
Flip a coin at this point.
I think we all know which side of the coin that I'm on. But yeah. Wow, we're out of time. That hour and a half flew by. Thank you so much, Sammy, for joining us. Listeners, if you want to hear more, hear our amazing back catalog of really, really great takes that have aged really well, because we have yet to be wrong on this show, especially with shorting Tesla. I'm very proud of that. That's my investor tip. Always short Tesla. Check us out on Apple iTunes Podcast.